Hey guys, welcome back to the podcast, episode 2. So obviously I'm blasting through the journey, and you know, I did like 45 minutes last time and I stopped. And then as I'm driving home, I'm like, damn, I should have said this and should have said that. So I'm going to just go back. It's impossible to remember everything. And even the stuff I remember, I don't want to get bogged down in one area too long. So let me just jump back and cover a couple of things that I think will be beneficial. When I was growing up in Ireland, as a young teenage boy, a little bit of a wild side, kind of broke into some places and stole some stuff, but honestly it was mostly for the adrenaline, and I don't think I knew that at the time. It was not for the swag, like you're gonna steal a lot at a school, really, pencils, I mean, what are you gonna steal? But I think I enjoyed the adrenaline, and that kind of stayed with me my whole life, and at the time I didn't even realize it. We used to break into pubs and steal booze, beer. I didn't even drink much. I drank a little bit, but I remember when I was like 15, 16, we broke into a pub one night and we stole a keg of beer. Now, a keg of beer is 90 pints of beer in a metal container, right? And without all the hookups to it, to put the gas in it or whatever the hell they do at the pub, it's just stale, flat beer. It's nasty, like dishwater. So, but it's hard for two scrawny little 15-year-olds to pick up a keg of beer. So I remember, and I was thinking about this yesterday and I was laughing. I remember we got a bicycle somehow and we put the keg of beer on the bar of the bike and we put a coat on it and we walked it down the street like we were fooling. I think we might have been drunk. We were fooling anybody. Like I can imagine somebody looking at us pushing this person with no legs down the road on the bicycle. Master criminals. But I did like the adrenaline and I did like that rush, and it kind of took me out of my mundane life. All right, so I've done some stuff before. I keep talking about officers and my problem with the officer corps. Now, I think it's broader than that. I think it's a leadership thing. And as you come up in the army as a young man, a young woman, you just accept that things are done the way they are. And this is how the army is. But having the benefit of hindsight now and looking back on it, having been in two different armies, I can look back and I can point out things that just at the time did not make sense. And I did question stuff. Even as a young private, I was like, this makes no sense. And I've always been the guy who questions stuff. It's probably annoying for people that I'd worked for, but sometimes you look at something and you go, this makes no sense. So Ireland obviously was occupied by the British for 900 years. And when it got its independence, the south of Ireland, the 26 counties, which are the Republic of Ireland, in the 1920s, the British pulled out and they stayed in the six counties in the north, which are Northern Ireland now, and still problematic, to say the least. But when the Republic of Ireland got its independence, the newly formed Irish Army just took all the stuff from the, like, equipment and uniforms and drilling ceremonies. And for a country that was subjugated by the British for 900 years, you'd think they'd want nothing to do with the British way of doing things. Now, it was okay to take the weapons and the uniforms and the drill even, but to take the class system is a little mind-boggling to me. Now, especially after World War One, there's a lot of revolution around the world. There was a lot of these dictators and royalty that were just... people were thrown into the cauldron in World War One, and soldiers were just sent across the top into machine gun fire, and they were mowed down in massive numbers, and people started thinking, this is insane, right? So this class system, which had ruled the world since the beginning, was very destructive to the lower classes, and it was all built for the upper class. So the Irish took that class system into the military, and it is still there today. And if you look at any army that was a former British colony, it is still there. I went to a thing when I was in Somalia years later. I went to the Indian Army to meet their commander about this evacuation thing. But we sat down to dinner, and the privates brought the food in, and it was obviously a massive class system. And that is still there, and that is from the British Army. Now, the Irish Army took that class system and ran with it hard. And I would say it's probably still there today to some degree. So when I was in basic training in Ireland, I had the commander, the officer in charge of our recruit platoon was like 20 years old, maybe. And he was an idiot, right? Like most 20-year-old men are. The way the officer corps was selected back then, and probably still the same today, I'm not sure, but you come out of high school, and the leaving cert, honestly, is a little, it's like an associate's degree. It is quite difficult, but it's not. It's a high school diploma. You come out of high school, and you got chosen to be an officer in the army. Then you went to 18 months of cadet training. And when you graduated, you became a second lieutenant in the army. So you're 18, 19 and a half, maybe less than 20 years old, and you're a second lieutenant in the army. Then you went to a unit, which this guy who was in charge of our recruit platoon was our lieutenant commander. You went to a unit and you stayed there for about a year or 18 months. And then after that, you became a first lieutenant. And then you went to college for 4 years on an army officer's pay. So everybody else in college is eating ramen noodles and freaking counting their pennies. And they have money and cars and they're just living up that life, right? So the difference between that and the American Army is you have a college degree before you go in, before you become an officer. Not that a college degree does anything for you, but at least you spend a couple of years studying and you're a little more mature, okay? So this kid, and he was a kid, and he was the same age as the rest of us, or slightly older, came in and he was the commander of our recruit platoon. Now, again, try to stay away from bashing officers too much, but NCOs should have controlled him. But it would have been so not normal culturally for even a seasoned sergeant to pull that guy to one side and say, you are screwing up. What the hell are you doing? Like, I would do that as an NCO in the American Army in a heartbeat, and I have done it. But back then, there was such a difference in class that it was unheard of almost, right? So this guy comes in, and we didn't see him that much, but he would come in and do room inspections. Now, if you do a room inspection and you toss a bunk like it's dirty or whatever, and you rant and rave on one guy, then it has a lot more effect than if you come in and just toss everybody's bunk, or you just upend the bunk and trash the thing and yell and scream. People get immune to that very, very quickly, and it becomes a joke. And that's what he would do. I put a picture on my Instagram there the other day, and it's me in basic training where I look like I'm 12, but the wall locker behind me, on top of the wall locker, we used to have to disassemble all our kit. So we'd a backpack and pouches and all that, and we'd have to stack it. So you'd have your backpack, and then you'd have all the pouches, and on top you'd have your helmet, and it sat on the top of your wall locker. He was trying to pull the drawer out during an inspection on my wall locker, and he pulled it so hard that the helmet fell off the top of the bunk, off the top of the wall locker, and cranked him on the back of the head. He was a running joke. If you inspect soldiers, what they call in Ireland, on parade or in formation, and you yell and you kick somebody off parade, that should be a pretty big deal. But when you kick three quarters of the platoon off, then the guys who stay put are standing at attention, and the guys who got kicked off are around the back of the building laughing and joking and smoking cigarettes, right? And he became a joke, and nobody took him seriously. But NCOs should have been able to pull him to one side and say, look, stop, you're embarrassing yourself. But that would have been very, very culturally not normal. Now, you take when I graduated and I served along the border in the Irish Army, we had a company plus in that base, right? So a company, a soldier, 100 men, and we had, I think it was Alpha Company, A Company, and then we had like a support company, so maybe 120 men there. probably three quarters or more were privates, a few NCOs, a few officers. There was three different dining facilities on that facility. There was one for privates, one for non-commissioned officers, and one for officers. There was three, we call them mess halls there, but here a mess hall is the dining facility. There was three bars on that facility, one for privates, one for NCOs, and one for officers. And you did not go to somebody else's dining facility or mess hall or bar. It just was unheard of, right? So the biggest dining facility was for the privates, and they would go in and get their tray, and they would line up and get their food like we do in the American Army. Everybody in the American Army gets chow the same way. NCOs would go in and sit down, and a private would come out with his notebook and pen and ask them what they would like at a restaurant, and he would take their order, and then he would go get the food and bring it to them. And then the officer's mess was just ridiculous. They had a guy full-time there to cater to their freaking every need, basically. And this is obviously a throwback from the British Army, and nobody questioned it. It was ridiculous. Now, this separation, I do believe that there should be a healthy distance between NCOs and not at that stand. When I mean, if you're the team sergeant on a special forces team, you probably shouldn't be out drinking beer with your boys. That's just my philosophy. If you're the platoon sergeant, you shouldn't be going to parties at the private's house, right? That's there needs to be a professional distance. However, this was taken to a ridiculous level, and I think part of it was to maintain professionalism, but you lose so much rapport. You imagine like a company of, plus, right? 100, 120 men, and you have three dining facilities in a military that was not well funded, right? Why would nobody look at that and go, why don't we collapse these two and everybody eats and we sit side by side, we break bread, and we kind of become more approachable? Not even talked about, right? You were not allowed to go into that private's mess hall. You were not allowed to go into that NCO's mess hall, officer mess, if you weren't didn't belong. It's kind of ridiculous. In South Lebanon, when I went there, our platoon leader was actually pretty squared away, and he was considered to be a good officer. Now, I that first trip, when I was a private, I stayed in a bunch of different places. We moved around every couple of weeks at sometimes. But one of the places we had a platoon minus on a house. And we would man a checkpoint from that house. So you're talking about a platoon is like 30. We might have had 24 people there, including an officer, a couple of NCOs, and the rest were privates. NCOs and privates did all the work. The officer didn't do anything. He was the officer. He wasn't expected to do anything. So we had guard duty on that house, and we had a man a checkpoint called Tibni Bridge that was a couple of miles away. That checkpoint was manned 24 hours a day in 3 8-hour shifts. And it wore your ass down. Not once did I ever see that officer say, hey, NCO, I got this. I'll come down and take your shift. Never happened. Not once did I see that officer say, I will pull guard duty tonight just to help out. Never happened. And was not expected. And probably he would have got disciplined by the commander if he did that. And that's the mentality. Also, I remember the room I stayed in, there was probably six privates in there, six, seven privates crammed in this tiny room, probably the size of this one. And on the second floor, the officer's room was two big massive rooms with a balcony, and he had his writing desk, and it was just, he was living in luxury while we were all crammed there. Now that was very, very normal, but you would think anybody with common sense would go, if you were the officer, you'd go, this doesn't sit well with me. I know it's how things are done, but I'm going to take this small room. Hey, you guys go up there. You're working your ass off. You need to have a little bit of space to unpack your bags. All right? Not even considered. And still very, very normal. And then the last thing, and this was a cultural thing, right? The last thing was when you went to Lebanon, you had to take a certain amount of military equipment with you to do your job. Now, people tried to pack as lightly as possible because one of the perks was you could buy stuff there pretty much on the black market that was way cheaper than buying it in Ireland. People bought gold. I didn't. Stereos like Walkmans were a big thing. And for guys that were not well paid, it was a huge perk to be able to buy that gear and bring it back. So, but obviously there's a weight limit on everybody. So you reduce your amount. Some guys would mail home some of their military kit and buy stereos and bring them back with them. On when you're relieving a battalion like that, right, obviously you don't all leave at the same time. So a third of the new battalion would come in, and a third would go home, and then the next week another third, another chalk would come in, you know, a third go home, and then eventually over 3 weeks you did it. On my trip, my first trip, they took officers from Ireland who did not do the 6 months of hard work, and they flew them out on the first chalk. They got to spend a week or two there, get a suntan, buy all the stuff on the black market, and come back on the last chalk, which reduced the weight allowance for every soldier on that trip who just busted his ass for 6 months. Also, when we finally got back to Ireland, they took us off the plane and put us through customs, who searched all our bags and charged us for every item we had, charged tax on every item we had. Talk about shafting guys like for a few dollars. It was ridiculous, and it annoyed me at the time. But again, that's the way things had always been. And you know, in hindsight, looking back, you should question everything. You really should. You look at stuff and it just doesn't make sense. Be like, why are we doing this? It does not make sense. And I've seen it throughout my career. Okay, that's the couple of things I thought of that I just bounced, and I'll bounce back and forth like this as I go through. So I get back to Ireland. One of the NCO, that's the other thing I was going to talk about, was rules of engagement. I talked briefly on the last one about the rules of engagement on the border. Defend your own life, defend your comrade's life, protect your post, stop yourself from force, blitz on, prevent serious damage to government property, justification, prevention, compliance with law, minimum force. Got it read to me every single day for years. And it's engraved, tattooed on my brain, I'll never forget it. When you went to Lebanon, it was way worse, right? This is insane to that. Like, I understand the UN, right? I understand that they're not a fighting force, they're blue berets and big white vehicles, and they're a presence, and it's almost like a deterrent because you have to, I get all that, right? However, you should be tactically minded to a certain point. The rules of engagement in Lebanon, where if you got fired at, on, let's say you're on an observation post, you're on top of a hilltop and you've built a base there, and the Israelis or the South Lebanese army or the Hezbollah opened fire on you. You were supposed to, and I say supposed to because I don't know anybody actually did this, but you were supposed to fire two red flares in the air to show them that they're firing at a UN position. If you got fired at again, you were supposed to fire two more. If you got fired at again, you were supposed to shoot warning shots. If you got fired at again, this is the fourth time, you were supposed to shoot containing shots, like around them, which is the stupidest thing I ever heard. And then if you were fired at again, you could return fire. But you could only return fire with the same caliber you were being fired at, right? So if they're firing AK-47s at you and you have a 50 cal sitting there, you can't use it. Absolutely stupid. Absolutely ridiculous. And we didn't do it. We got fired at and we immediately returned fire. And when the smoke cleared, we fired two red flares in the air and we kind of covered our tracks. But we shouldn't have had to. I was in a little OP on that first trip. And we had an NCO attached to us from the Ranger Wing, the Special Ops Unit in Ireland that I eventually went to. And he was more professional than the NCOs we had. He was more warrior mindset than the NCOs we had. And he was not afraid to shake things up. A lot of people disliked him. I actually liked him. And he was a good mentor to me. And he kind of showed me what right looks like. So we're on this OP way out in the middle of the enclave, in a place where you almost couldn't get to. After dark especially, and there was a small village there called Atiri, and most of the men were gone. They'd ran because they didn't want to get, you know, rolled up by the Israelis, or they'd been killed, or they joined the militia. But it's mostly old ladies and kids in this village, very poor, very poverty stricken. I'd actually love to go back there now and have a look at it, and I hope it's in better shape than it was. So we're in this OP and there's probably two squads of us. And we're basically there to report Israeli movement. That's kind of what our job was. So we're on this OP at night and we take fire, right? And, you know, we're supposed to shoot warning shots and contain all this crap. And the guy from the Ranger Wing immediately returns fire on the 240 machine gun, which is the Mag 58 7.62 machine gun. And he starts lacing all the tops to the walls and into the wood line and everything, right? And why he was a corporal too, he's a squad leader. Why he was on the 240, I'm not sure. But when the smoke had cleared, we waited, nothing happened. Now, no quick reaction force could get to us because the roads were mined and moving at night was extremely dangerous. So we kind of stayed on a high security posture all night. We didn't hit jack shit. But the next morning, we reported that we fired flares because nobody was near us. And we reported we went through all this BS protocol. So the next morning, the armored vehicles coming out with the company commander and all these officers, right, to check out the area. So I'm on guard duty on top of this roof, and it's mist everywhere. And I look around, I see this guy. I'm not going to say his name, but people know him. And he comes up, and he's got a pickaxe with him. And I was like, what the hell are you doing? He's like, I'm going to make some bullet holes. So there I was standing on top of this roof with him holding my belt, and I was using the pickaxe to put bullet holes along the top of the wall and against the fortifications around the position. And then this whole entourage come up and they're getting the whole debrief from us, and they're like, oh yes, we can see the bullet holes here. And they look at the wall and they're like, oh, I can see where the bullet hit here and ricocheted this way. And I was talking to one of these officers and I looked down right at the very base of the roof, like on the ground, and the pickaxe was laying there. And you know, if you're on audio, you can't see it, but the top of the pickaxe was completely bent from us making bullet holes on the wall. And you had to do what you had to do to cover yourself, right? So had we not covered our tracks like that, they probably would have disciplined that guy for returning fire without doing this whole BS protocol, right? So rules of engagement are extremely important to me. And as I went through that, Ireland, Lebanon, Ranger Wing, and then I went as a contractor in Somalia and American military and special operations, war on terror and all that. And they change and they change and they change and they change over time. Now, you have the inherent right to self-defense no matter where you go, but depending on how the war is going, they change, right? I heard a story once, and I don't know how true it is, that when the Germans had taken over France and you know, the World War II had really kicked off, the British were dropping leaflets into occupied Germany saying, don't support Hitler, you know, he's going to lead to the destruction, blah, blah, usual leaflet drop stuff, right? And the guy on the plane, on the bird, pushing the leaflet bundles out, one time forgot to cut the bundle, so it fell as a brick and killed a civilian on the ground. And early on in the war, they actually wanted to charge that guy with involuntary manslaughter or criminal negligence or something like that. Now, say that's 1941. You want to fast forward like 2 years and we're firebombing German cities, trying to kill as many civilians as possible. That's why I say the rules of engagement change depending on how the war is going. Okay? So I'm a huge student of rules of engagement, and we teach it now in the personal security course. We teach when you can shoot to self, you know, protect your life. We teach when to draw that gun, when not to draw that gun, how to mitigate situational awareness, self-defense, all that stuff is part of that personal security course. Check the link below. I've put a link in the YouTube video and on the podcast to our training page. Please look at getting training if you can. We train all over the country, and it's not just firearms. It's personal security, it's land navigation, it's medical training, it's survival training, it's canning and jarring, it's edible plants. We do a lot of training, and our instructors are awesome. That was a very, very seamless plug in there, but I don't have ads, so there you go. All right, so in Lebanon, the rules of engagement were absolutely ridiculous, and you do what soldiers do. You get around it the best you could, okay? And I'll talk in depth about this later on, especially when I get to the global war on terror. So I'm back in Ireland. I had this guy who was kind of a mentor in the Ranger Wing. So I didn't know much about the Ranger Wing. And then I'm on duty one day in my home base, and the Ranger Wing come up to do border operations. And immediately they pull in different vehicles. They have different guns. They have different kit. They're all physically fit. They look like they look like professional soldiers. And they were turning in their weapons into the arms room and their ammo, and you pick up a couple of mags of 5.56 because they were running HK rifles, and you compare it to a couple of mags of 7.62, and I'd never really been exposed to 5.56 except a little bit in Lebanon, right, with M16s and stuff like that on checkpoints. So very, very interested in moving in that direction. Kind of bored doing border stuff, kind of bored doing cash escorts and stuff. Like, I wanted to do something a little better and a little more difficult. At the time, commanders would not let people go to selection. They would crush it. You'd have to get permission from your commander to go to selection, and commanders didn't want to be losing their best soldiers, so they'd stop you and you wouldn't be allowed to go. And it got so bad that the Ranger Wing had gotten permission from Army headquarters to go around the commander. So they used to do these road shows where they come in and they give a briefing on the unit. It's like a recruiting briefing that we still do in America now all the time. And they'd say, look, if you apply and you get refused, go through your chain of command first. But if you get refused, then, check the time. If you get refused, then call this number and we'll make sure you're allowed to go. Okay, so I put the paperwork in, got refused, and I called down to the unit and they did some stuff, and all of a sudden I got orders to go. And now you've burned a bridge with your home unit and it's good incentive not to come back. So I go to selection, and again, no internet, not really know anything. Unless you knew somebody who went to selection and failed because they're back in their unit, you really have no idea what to expect. And probably better off that way. I was physically fit, I was mentally tough, but I had no idea. I'd found basic training difficult for about the first week, and then just normal. And you know, you do something long enough, you just get used to it, and normal seems weird at that point, right? So that's why quitting never really made sense to me, because people who quit mentally, if you just hung on for another couple of days, you'd probably get used to what you were doing, and it would be fine, right? So I got a selection. Didn't know much about it. The Ranger Wing, the Army Ranger Wing, is the Special Operations Unit in Ireland. It was started up in 1980 as a response to all this terrorism that was going on, aircraft hijackings, a lot of stuff going on in the 1970s. So it got stood up, and they when they stood it up, they're like, okay, we've no idea what we're doing, let's figure it out. And they sent a couple of guys to Ranger School in America, and they sent a couple of officers, of course, to Ranger School in America, and they came back and they stood up the unit. One second. So in 1980, and I went in 1987, I think 87, maybe 88. It was kind of built off the Ranger School POI, right? Some time in the garrison, learning all these skills. Then a lot of time in the mountains, a lot of patrolling, a lot of raids and ambushes and all that. But at the end, if you got selected, then you would go to the unit. If you finished it, but you weren't selected, you could get a Ranger tab, go back to your unit, and or you just got kicked out or dropped. A lot of people quit. And the way it was run, the guys in the Ranger Wing very early on, the first couple of years and probably up to the point of the class before mine, maybe, very tough, very hard men, but not real creative, right? Not real. There's a balance, right? You want intelligent people, but you want them to be tough, and you want a balance there, right? These guys were hard as nails, but they're the type of guys, like when you're navigating over a mountain, you probably don't want to walk in a straight line distance, right? Because you'll go down and up and down and up, as opposed to staying up on the high ground and contouring around and just be work smarter, not harder. They weren't that type of guy. They were the type of guy that would just go straight through things. And but it started changing. Now, selection is a big part of that. Selection for me was extremely physically tough, and we broke a lot of guys there. Now, I'm not bashing the Ranger Wing. That's how things were done back there. And I'm sure the American military for Special Operations and Delta Force is very similar at the time. You tested people physically and not that much mentally. Whereas now there's a balance, because there should be a balance, right? So lots of sleep deprivation, lots of running, lots of rucking, not a lot of food. Like I remember early in the morning, it's funny because I went back to the Ranger Wing much, much later when I was a sniper instructor, and one of the guys there who was in the unit was like kid when I went through, and he said, I remember you guys running at 4 o'clock in the morning, because he lived on post because his dad was in the military, running past my house at 4 o'clock in the morning singing. And he was like, what the hell is that? But when you take guys and you put them, you know, squat down, rifle up over the head, squatting, walking, duck walking up and down hills, and you're going to produce a lot of injuries, and a lot of people got hurt. I think we started, and I'm not sure, but I think we started with 88 people. And I think we finished with like 10, and maybe 6 or 8 got selected to go to the unit. It was a tough course, but again, you get used to it. Now, if you got selected, you immediately turned around and came back to the unit for like 4 months probation and like training, like OTC in America, or the 2 course in America, right? So you did what's called the skills course, and you went through that training. The officers who went through selection, they went through the same selection, and you didn't even know they were officers. They didn't come back immediately. They, unless there was a slot in the unit for them, they came back whenever a vacancy opened up. However, when they came back, and when I went to the skills course, OTC, we had an officer in the skills course who'd passed selection, and you know, a vacancy opened up, so he was coming to the unit, but he did not do the Q course. He supervised the Q course, right? No training in any of this stuff. He supervised it. So he was on the Q course with us, but he wasn't. He was in the headquarters doing whatever officers do, and he would breeze in and breeze out whenever he wanted. Now, I understand the mentality of that, but it's so flawed. They did not want him shooting with Corporal Owens, and Corporal Owens being able to outshoot him, because they thought that that would be a loss of respect, rapport, whatever you think. It's actually the opposite. The fact that you will not come to training with us crushes rapport. It crushes that rapport, and it builds up that them and us. It's like the chow halls back in the infantry, right? 3 chow halls create separation. 1 chow hall creates camaraderie, and it breaks down this them and us mentality, in my opinion. So he did not do the training we did. He was in charge of it, which is so flawed. We did a cordon and search exercise one time, and we were practicing. This was while I was on the skills course. We were practicing for an operation that the unit had done. There'd been a bank robbery with a guy with a sawn-off rifle, and I think the other guy had a handgun. They were on a motorcycle, and they robbed the bank, and they were coming out, getting on the bike, and an off-duty police officer saw them and hit them with his car and mashed one of their legs, and they get up and killed him. He unarmed, of course. Cops don't have guns, right? So, and then they ran into a wood line, and then the military came out, cordon the whole wood line, and then pushed through to find these guys. So we were practicing that. It's called a cordon and search. Actually happened a lot. So they put opposing forces, guys playing the up for, in there. This officer who was in charge of our probation or our skills course, he came out to play the opposing force, and he went in there, and he was deep in the woods, and we were online basically sweeping through trying to find him, and he climbed a tree. And we were trying to get him out of the tree, and he wouldn't come down, and he was calling us all kinds of names. And, training like that just gets to a stupid point. That's, and it's just, like, ridiculous. And there was a kid with me on probation, and somebody climbed up there and grabbed him and ripped him out of the tree, and he still wanted to fight and he was resisting. And the kid that was with me on probation took his MP5 and cracked him across the back of the head and split his head open. And weirdly, he wasn't disciplined for that. That was the thing about it. Like, we trained hard and it got very, very physical sometimes, but that would not, he would be disciplined for speaking out of turn, but he was not disciplined for that. Actually, the NCOs thought it was pretty freaking funny. But he split that officer's head open, who later became a commander of the unit. But that's, I'm going to circle back here real quick. In the Irish Army, as a corporal, you had the right, like in the American Army, an NCO, even a Master Sergeant Major, he can't give an Article 15. Article 15 is a charge. He can recommend it, it goes to commander, and he makes the decision, right, depending on who you're doing it against. As a corporal in the American Army, if you run your mouth, now I've never done this, I've actually never even seen it done, but if you run your mouth to me and you're disrespectful, I can grab two privates and say, fall in, I can march you to the guardroom, I can take your laces and your belt, and I can lock you in a cell, and your pay stops. And it might take 2 or 3 days for the commander to read that charge. And even if the commander dismisses it, I've locked your ass up for 3 days. Okay? It's like a police officer having a firearm, right? It's there if he needs it. And because he has it, people give him that respect. And because you had the ability to do that in the Irish Army, I've never, ever in my experience seen a private tell an NCO to go screw himself, or an officer, right? There was that discipline there because that was like a weapon that was here for you if you needed to use it. So in that respect, it was very disciplined, kind of in that way, right? So the kid didn't get disciplined. He got kicked out of OTC later on, or out of the skills course later on for another reason. And he was a little bit of a loose cannon. And when you deal with a unit that you know, at that level, you can't have loose cannons. So went through that skills course, that operator training course, learned how to shoot, learned how to shoot a handgun, submachine guns, MP5s, HK-53s, HK-33s, sniper rifles, breaching, CQB, lots and lots and lots of CQB. Went trained on retaking offshore gas rigs off the coast of Ireland, which is really, really cool. Went and trained on retaking hijacked aircraft up in Dublin Airport. Did a whole range of training and skills. Now, the unit at the time, you're talking 88, I think. The Northern Ireland thing was freaking going hard at that point. And the Rangerwing up to that point had been very internal. Training had been very internal. We had some guys go to the Royal Dutch Marines and train. We had some guys go to some other places, but mostly you're just recycling the same training. And you must take in training from other units around the world. Now, going across the pond and training with the SAS was not an option because I doubt the SAS would have trusted us anyway, but it politically, it was a powder keg. At the time, Thatcher was the Prime Minister of England, and Thatcher had basically declared war on the IRA and launched the SAS over to bring the fight to the enemy. And there'd been a lot. There's a podcast called The Troubles Podcast, which breaks down specific portions of the Northern Ireland conflict, which I'd highly recommend because it's not biased. It just gives you the facts. But for a whole host of reasons, we were not allowed to go and train with the British SAS. Now, we had officers go to, officer courses within the British Army, like the Recce Commander's course and stuff like that. We had officers and NCOs at that time start to go to GSG9, German Special Ops, Counter-Terrorist Police, the GIGN, French, and a few others. And the stuff they brought back was mostly super valuable. Some of it was absolute garbage, but most of it was super valuable. They came back, the SAS, there was a whole controversy in Northern Ireland at this time that the SAS had a shoot-to-kill policy. And yes, they did. Of course they did. The IRA had a shoot-to-kill policy too, but the IRA were using this as a media way to kind of, you know, delegitimize what the British were doing, right? So the Irish government were very, very adamant that we would not unleash the Ranger Wing with a shoot-to-kill policy. So they went, these guys went to France, to the GIGN, which are police force, counter-terrorist police force, and a very good one. And they started hammering this minimum force shit, minimum force, minimum force, minimum force. Now, soldiers are not good at minimum force, not really what we do, even special operations. So they actually had us on the range drawing and shooting at targets with a gun and shoulder shooting them. So they dropped the gun. I mean, that's just dumb, right? They had us very, very focused on that. And I remember we did an exercise one time and we, you know, we do all the hostage negotiations, snipers are in place, gathering down, and then the assault was going in. There's four of us stacked at a door. And the guy inside playing the op four or the opposing force or playing the bad guy, he wanted to see if we were getting this minimum force thing. So he put his gun down and walked out. And we were shooting, we were running simmunitions. So you had two guys with pistols, Sig Sauer P226s, and two guys in MP5s. And I was one of the guys with the MP5. And he came out because what he wanted to see is us arresting him. And we shot him like 50 times. Like I think I dumped like two magazines into him, right? Not great at the whole minimum force thing. But it was just badly done, and you could still have rules of engagement, but when somebody's pointing a gun at you, they voted. They voted, and you don't try to shoot the gun out of his hand. That's ridiculous, and that is kind of being pushed by people who've never been in a gunfight. Now, I questioned that at the time, and I was like, this is insane. This is not what we do. And it was kind of very, very annoying for me. Now, the unit had two roles. It had a black role and a green role. And the black role was this counter-terrorist SWAT team, balaclava, all black, MP5, stormed the building, Iranian embassy, SAS type role. And I we were quite good at that. And the other role was like this green role, this behind enemy lines, conventional warfare, sniper operations, stuff like that. And then within the unit, you generally had a lot of broad skills, like any special ops unit, and then you specialized in whatever you wanted. So when I'd been in Cyprus, I went diving one time, and I thought it was really cool. Of course, it was the Mediterranean, it was beautiful, and it was warm, and it was really, really nice. And I was like, I'd like to be a diver. And they took us on a familiarization dive, and it was awful. Of course, it was winter in Ireland, in cold water and nasty, dirty lake with dead cats in it, and it was just awful. So I was like, I don't want to do this. This sucks. Let me be a sniper. So then I went and trained as a sniper in the unit. Again, not a centralized school, because there was no centralized school at the time, I don't even think. The unit just put on a sniper course, and then you had this internal churning of the same TTPs and the same skills. And it took a lot to kind of reach outside and pull information in from somewhere else and open up your eyes. The Irish government at that time were very, very reluctant to get involved with anything to do with Northern Ireland. They were, hey, look, IRA, you leave us alone, we leave you alone. And that's just a fact. We did border operations. We did some stuff. We did some covert operations along the border. We did hit targets. And look, when the IRA or the INLA or the Loyalist paramilitary spilled into the south and start robbing banks and blowing stuff up and kidnapping people, generally they crossed the line and we would get involved at that point. But most of the time, the Irish government did not want us to be heavy-handed with the IRA, right? Now, the IRA had as far as I know, I don't know if this is fact, but it probably is, they had a policy not to get in gunfights with Irish security forces south of the border, because politically, an insurgency lives off the people that support it. And if you lose the support of the people because you kill a bunch of cops and soldiers, then it's going to hurt you politically. So they would sooner surrender, turn in their arms, go to jail for a little while and learn from it. There was some sort of underhanded deal going on there, but it was what it was. In about 1990, Margaret Thatcher came to Ireland for a European Community Summit. I think it was 90. It might have been 91, or I think it was 90. But she was coming in to Dublin from London to do a summit about border security and European Community and all that kind of stuff. We, prior to this, Gaddafi had, Ronald Reagan, I think in 85 or 87, had bombed Gaddafi. And the planes flew out of RAF Mildenhall in England. And Gaddafi got pissed off at the British. And he sent, those bombing raids killed his daughter, by the way. They did not get him. They killed his daughter. And he was mad. So he sent 6 shiploads of arms to the IRA. The IRA had been kind of for a very long time very outdated weapons. They got some guns from America. They were building up their arsenal, but 6 shiploads of arms came from Gaddafi. You're talking about AK-47s, millions of rounds of ammunition, Semtex, which at the time was tough to detect. You can have homemade explosives, ammonium nitrate, and fuel oil, right? But it's only so powerful, and you need to kick it generally with high explosives. And they had very little high explosives. They'd learned, when I say they, the IRA, had learned through trial and error over years, and became very, very good and very creative at building bombs and building improvised explosive devices, like probably the best in the world at it. I went, when I was in the infantry, we were sent, there was a bunch of us sent on what they call the specialist search team course. And there would be caches of weapons, there would be stuff along that border, and they wanted people that knew what the hell they were looking for. So they sent us down to Dublin to the engineer school, I think for 3 weeks, to learn how to make bombs and how to make IEDs and how to make explosives and what the scent was of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil and look at components. And, you know, special operations here do the same thing, right? Because you can come in and you can look at bomb ingredients and you need to know what you're looking at. You need to know that marzipan smell. You need to know what ammonium nitrate and fuel oil is and what the ingredients are, what to look for and fertilizer, all that stuff, right? So we went to this course for a couple of weeks. Super eye-opening. Obviously, the limit on improvised explosives is your imagination, right? All you got to do is complete that circuit, and you can do that in one of a million ways. And what a terrorist organization will do is they'll come up with a new TTP, tactics, techniques, and procedures, and they'll put it out there, and they'll watch the security forces' response to it, and then they'll counter that, and then the security forces will counter that, and then they'll counter it again. One story I heard, I think maybe at that school, there was a time when the IRA would put a bomb in. Now, if I'm a skilled bomb maker in the IRA, I am not, let me look at the time. Oh man, that's 48 minutes already. I am not putting myself at risk, right? So if I build bombs, I'm not going in and emplacing it. That's a waste of my talents. You don't want that guy getting rolled up. So they'd get kids to put the bomb in for them. So at one point, obviously the kid has to put the bomb in place and arm it and walk away. And the arming switch on a very crude device, I mean, it's not like that now, but it could be, is like a clothes peg. And the clothes peg is on the inside of a box with a small hole, right? And that you have a positive and negative separating the connection on the clothes peg with a piece of plastic or something non-conductant, separating those positive and negative. So the kid would put the bomb down and then pull that arming switch from the inside and leave it. Well, they'd had incidents where the kid would lose his nerve and he would not arm the bomb. And then the British would come and disarm it and they get all that evidence and fingerprints and all that kind of stuff. So they started putting the kid's name and address on the arming switch. So he had to pull that arming switch to complete the circuit. And he had to pull the arming switch to get his name and address, or the Brits would be coming for him real fast, all right? So I went to this 3-week school where we learned how to build bombs and we learned how to do improvised explosives and complete the search, so we would know what we were looking for when we went into a derelict building and were searching for tripwires and pressure pads and all this kind of stuff. And needless to say, all that training really stood to me later on in Afghanistan and Iraq. But I learned it there. We had a guy in our school with us who was in the infantry with us, and he was from the Falls Road in Belfast. The Falls Road is like a Catholic IRA stronghold. And at the end of the course, we had to build a bomb, and we had to have, I think, two switches on it, right? And a switch is a way to detonate it, right? So in place of a blasting cap or a detonator, we'd have a light bulb on the outside. So let's say it's an ammo can, and you know, it has an anti-lift switch on it, so that the trigger's on the bottom. So when you lift it up, it completes the circuit and the light goes on. That's an example, right? And you know, we all built our own thing and we showed it. Well, this guy who was from the Falls Road, he built one that had like 9 switches in it. You couldn't barely look at this thing. It had an anti-lift switch. It had an anti-tilt switch. It had a light sensitive device. It had a freaking a tremor switch. It had a 9 different triggers on it. And the instructor looked at it and said, "Oh my God, I'm glad you're on our side." I was on the same course as this guy, and he was not trained by us. He was much, much better. Just saying. All right, so I went to this course, gained a ton of knowledge, and it really did stand to me later on, both in Ireland and later on in deployments to Afghanistan and Iraq during the war on terror, and in Somalia too. So went to selection, graduated, did tons and tons and tons of training, did some operations on the border, did a lot of PT, did a lot of shooting, did a lot of training, and became quite proficient, but got a little bored, honestly. And that's that young man trying to look for the next thing. And sometimes it can be, it can hurt you. And sometimes it can lead. And I have no regrets about any decision I made, because they led me to this moment right here. And this moment where I am right now is pretty freaking awesome. So, but at the time you don't see that. I went back to Lebanon a second time while I was in the Ranger Wing. And I'll just tell this one and then we'll wrap it up. I went back to Lebanon a second time as a squad leader, as a corporal, which is like a staff sergeant in the American Army, attached to a regular infantry unit, because the Ranger Wing did not deploy as a unit. They just put their guys who wanted to go and make a lot of extra money. You got attached to a regular infantry unit. And so I got sent up to Dublin and got attached to an infantry unit from Dublin, where I was dealing with soldiers really for the first time in my career, because I was a non-commissioned officer in the Ranger Wing, but we were all NCOs. So I really wouldn't charge anybody. And then I got pulled and I got sent in there, and now I'm in a platoon in charge of soldiers who could buy and sell you most of the time. And I remember when I was going, one of the more senior guys in the Ranger Wing said, "Look, let me give you a little bit of advice. You're going up there, you're not dealing with Ranger Wing guys. You're dealing with regular Army guys who will manipulate you, who will lie to you, who will try to get any kind of leverage on you. And you've got to be firm, and you've got to be strong, and you've got to be a leader." And I was like, "I got it. I got this, right?" And I've lived my life like that. If you do anything wrong as a leader and your subordinates see it, you can never, ever discipline them again. Ever, because they have leverage on you and you allowed that to happen. I've seen it time and time again. When I was in Lebanon the first time, there was, you know, alcohol on the checkpoints and stuff like that. Now, alcohol is part of the culture in Ireland. Everybody knows that. There was times when you could go into the canteen in the middle and you know, that's another conversation. However, this guy had a bottle of whiskey up in the friggin' machine gun position on a checkpoint, and the NCO stayed in the middle and they rotated, and he'd been tipping away at the whiskey. So it was time to rotate, and the guy went up there to relieve him, and then he came back down, and the NCO was like, "What are you doing?" And he said, he wants to stay there. And the NCO was like, "No, relieve him." And he goes up there, and the guy's been drinking, so he lets him away with it. He puts him in, he takes care of him. Something happened a couple of weeks later, and he tries to discipline this guy, and this guy turns it right back in his face and says, "If you do, I'm going to tell him that I was drinking on the checkpoint 3 weeks ago and you did nothing about it," right? He threw it back in his face. And so anytime you let that happen as a leader, you've lost all leverage and all ability to discipline people if you allow yourself to be banned. I've never in my career allowed that. So I was staunch, I was strict, I was I trained guys hard and I pushed guys hard and I held them accountable. But good guys like that. Good soldiers like that. And dirtbags put up with it because you're in the army. You'll do what you're freaking told. So I came in there and I was a whole lot more strict, disciplined, physically fit, trained than any other NCO. And we prepared and we trained and trained in Dublin. And then we deployed on my second trip to Lebanon, pretty much to the same area. But this time I was a non-commissioned officer and I had a lot more experience. And kind of the same type of trip, the same type of stuff was still going on. And it kind of disgusted me a little bit. All right, we are at 55 minutes. I don't know if that's a good place to stop. Look, guys, if you have questions and you want me to, when I do this next, I just don't want to make it too long and I don't want to kind of hover in the same area too long and bore you all to tears. So if you have questions and you want me to go into more detail, I remember where I left off and I will come back to that and I'll think of stuff myself. But there's a whole lot more to go. There's freaking getting out of the army. There's going to Somalia. People are hammering me. I'm like, oh, I can't wait for the Somalia one. I will talk about Somalia in pretty good depth. There's stuff I won't talk about, but I'll put more stuff out than I ever have before. And then going into the American army and all that kind of thing. So, I'm going to leave you one more story. You'll see coming up again and again and again. I've always been the guy who challenged the norm. When I later on when I went to the American Army and they told me this is how we do things, and I'm like, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. And I'm a private, and they're like, what? Who the hell is this guy, right? So question norms and go why. Ask why. Here's a little story I heard. I don't know if it's true or not, but it doesn't matter. There was a research facility in Germany. And they were researching the behavior of primates. So they had a big-ass cage with 10 chimpanzees in it. And they lowered a ladder down from the top with a bunch of bananas at the top of the ladder. And sure as hell, in short order, one of the chimps starts climbing the ladder. And as soon as he did, they hit them all with a fire hose. Hosed on all the chimps. An hour passes. Chimps think it's safe. A different one goes to climb the ladder, hit them all with the fire hose again. And this happened a couple of times. And chimps are smart. They learned. So none of them would climb the ladder to get to the bananas. So then they would take one of the chimps out and put a new one in who didn't know what was going on. And as soon as he tried to climb that ladder, they'd hit him all with the hose again. Okay? Then they'd switch out another one, and as soon as he tried to climb the ladder, all the other chimps would restrain him and beat his ass, basically, because they knew climbing that ladder to those bananas left means we're all going to get sprayed down with the water hose, right? So every time they would put a new chimp in there, he would try to climb the ladder, and they would all physically restrain him and beat his ass, right? Well, it got to the point that they kept switching out the chimps until no chimp in the cage had ever been sprayed. Because they were all new chimps, but they switched that one at a time. But still, when they put a new chimp in, he'd try to climb the ladder and they would all beat his ass. And they didn't even know why, because they'd never been sprayed. And the reason they were doing it is because that's how it's always been. And that became that learned behavior. And that is very dangerous. It's very dangerous in the military. It's very dangerous in the civilian world. It's very dangerous as a leader, no matter what you do. And I've seen it time and time and time again. And it was infectious in sniper school when I started working there as an instructor. It was, we do it this way. Well, why do we do it this way? Well, that's the way it's always been. And I hate that phrase. All right? Question everything. All right, guys. Until the next time. Thank you.